Operation Ice Dance is no longer a drill. Repeat, no drill. Post-slip comm intercepts indicate the Biko Independence Army is preparing a coup against the Colonial Chancellor. Under normal circumstances, we would share our intelligence with the Chancellor and place ourselves at her disposal. Circumstances are now anything but normal. Our mission against the Covenant still takes precedence. Captain Ascot and I agree that our original plan still offers the best chance of success, so Task Force Yama will occupy the Seoba Ice Quarry as planned. Unfortunately, we're not the only ones to recognize an abandoned quarry's value as a staging area. An insurrectionist force has already occupied Seoba, and appears to be using our quarry as a mustering area. John smiled inside his helmet. The 21st was going into battle under perilous conditions. And perilous conditions were what Spartans did best. Once Crowther saw how they performed under pressure, he'd be falling over himself to move them to the front of the attack. Crowther's message continued. The entire uniform code of military justice could have been compressed and transmitted in a single microburst. And John paid close attention, looking for opportunities for the Spartans to shine. The key to this operation will be isolating local forces before they can report they're under attack. To that end, the vanishing point will be jamming insurrectionist communications on Seoba. But we don't know what kind of anti-jamming or delayed transmission technology they may have. So, if you happen across anything that looks like a portable comm station, take it out. When the insurrectionist commanders lose contact with their force on Seoba, they'll probably assume the Chancellor's militia discovered their base and took it out. With any luck, that will force them to abandon their coup and fade back into hiding. But it could also push them into an early attack. Either way, they won't have any reason to return to Seoba. And if they do, our prowlers will make sure that none of their vessels get anywhere near us. To maintain operational security, we'll identify ourselves to any insurrectionist captives and survivors as Chancellor's Guards Battalion 5. Your accents won't sound right, but do it anyway. Our primary concern is keeping our nature hidden from the aliens, so once the prisoners are no longer in our hands, we want them confused about our identity. And the more confused, the better. Crowther's voice deepened. I cannot emphasize this enough. Humanity itself may depend on our success today. We must capture Seoba, and we must do it without revealing our presence to anyone off-moon. Do not hesitate to act with extreme prejudice against anyone who opens fire on you. I mean it. Do not think twice. You must not fail. The message ended. And John began to think about how far he could push his orders without actually violating them. After training with the Black Daggers for the last week, he had no doubts about their ability to eliminate a force of Biko Independence Army irregulars. But improvised operations had a way of exploding in an attacker's face, especially since UNSC commanders tended to underestimate insurrectionist capabilities. And something was bound to go wrong. When that happened, John would be ready to move his Spartans out front, where they would be able to use their speed and power to disrupt any enemy counterattack before it developed. If the Spartans could do that, they would save a lot of Black Dagger lives, and Crowther would be forced to trust their judgment under fire. He might even be grateful for the lesson. The drop bay's rear access hatch hissed open, and John looked over to see Ghost Flight Leader stepping into the drop bay. A square-faced officer with a bushy black mustache hanging over a heavy-lipped mouth, Hector Nieto wore a half-headset over curly hair and a rumpled gray service uniform with the lieutenant commander's gold oak leaves on the collar tabs. "Listen up, people," Nieto's voice came over the first platoon comnet. "Ghost Flight is dropping Alpha Company at the docks as planned, but there's a hitch. The insurrectionists have a comm center at the top of the mass driver. The prowlers will hit it hard on the way in, but you know how that goes. The bad guys could have it transmitting again in 30 minutes. Alpha Company's job is to prevent that." No one looked toward him. The drop bay was packed too tight for turning around. But the voice of the first platoon lieutenant, Nellie Ham, replied over the same comnet.
Thanks, Commander. How does that affect first platoon's objectives?
Nieto spread his hands in a gesture that only John and Avery Johnson, standing adjacent to Nieto's far shoulder on the opposite side of the access hatch, could see.
Your guess is as good as mine, he said.
Colonel Crowther's message wasn't specific. Maybe your captain will fill you in once you've hit the ice. Sure, Ham said. The company captain was with 3rd Platoon aboard Ghost Flight's number 3 Prowler, Ghostwind. If our own comms aren't being jammed.
You worry too much, Lieutenant, Nieto said. It's just rebels down there. They don't have jamming equipment.
Nieto crooked a finger at John, then backed out through the access hatch. John glanced over at Johnson, who was outfitted in the same Black Dagger space assault armor as everyone but John, and cocked his helmet in inquiry. Though Johnson was not technically above John in the chain of command, it had been made clear to him by both Captain Ascot and Dr. Halsey that John should give the sergeant's advice a lot of weight, especially when navigating the vagaries of protocol inherent in the Spartans' attachment to the 21st. Johnson merely spread his hands and gave a sharp nod toward the hatch. Whatever Nieto wanted, it was never wise to keep the commander of a Prowler flight waiting. John ducked through the access hatch and found the lieutenant commander standing in the passageway. He came to attention, banging his helmet against the overhead, and saluted.
You wanted to speak with me, sir?
Nieto returned the salute with a casual hand flip and waited for the hatch to close, then motioned John to remove his helmet.
This shouldn't go over any comms.
It would have been simpler to deactivate his communications system, but John felt certain that a lieutenant commander would realize that. He checked the chronometer on his HUD again, then broke the airtight seal on his skin suit and removed his helmet.
I hope we can make this fast, Commander. It will take a couple of minutes for me to reseal, and Lieutenant Ham will vac the drop bay 5 minutes before
she'll vac it when I tell her to.
Nieto grinned up at John.
So don't worry, okay?
I'm infantry, John replied. I worry or I die.
Yeah, but not when it comes to getting left behind, Nieto said. At least aboard my boats.
I see how valuable you Spartans are.
Very kind of you to say so, John said. It still wouldn't be good if I were the reason the dismount was delayed.
Nieto waved a dismissive hand.
Don't worry about Crowther. He can't cause you any serious trouble.
Not with Mike Stanforth backing you.
You say don't worry a lot, John observed.
Worry interferes with clear thought.
Nieto's grin broadened, and he added, But then again, you're infantry. Maybe clear thought isn't an advantage.
Ha ha, sir, John said, very funny. Can we get to the point?
Nieto gave a hearty laugh.
And not worried about me at all, I see.
He took a second to collect himself. Then the mirth drained from his face, and he craned his neck back so he could look John square in the eye.
Actually, I wanted to apologize.
To you and the other Spartans.
Apologize for what, sir?
For the snafu at Netherup, Nieto said. The open transmission.
That was one of my people. So it's on me.
I see, John said.
He had complained to Captain Ascot, of course, but that had been primarily to mollify Daisy 023 and some of the other Spartans who had been angered by the mistake. He had not really expected to hear anything more about the matter, as such things were usually handled far above a petty officer's pay grade.
Thank you, then. I'll pass the word on to the rest of the squad.
I'd appreciate that, Nieto said.
But I hope you won't let Spartan 023 anywhere near Mike Ruman. He's actually a pretty good sensor operator, and I can't afford to lose him.
John recalled what Daisy had wanted to rip off, and it was his turn to be embarrassed.
You heard the playback of our mission?
Yes. The crewman did, too, Nieto said.
But just that part. Dr. Halsey wanted to be sure we appreciated the gravity of the situation. John wasn't happy about having TeamCom downloads being shared, but he knew that Halsey was just trying to protect her Spartans.
She could be a little extreme about that. Dr. Halsey expects perfection. That she does. Naieto chuckled. By the time she let us go, my petty officer was so sick about it that he was volunteering to find Spartan 023 and introduce himself. That would be a mistake, John said. Tell him I'll pass his apologies along. No reason it has to go any further than that. As long as it doesn't happen again. It won't, Naieto said. I was yelling at him louder than Halsey did. I thought he'd gotten you all killed. But I guess I'd forgotten who you guys are. John frowned. What do you mean? You know. How good you are, Naieto said. I guess that's what happens when you start training at 5. 5? John blurted. Actually, they hadn't even been conscripted until they were 6. But Naieto's information was closer to the mark than it should have been. Where did you hear that? Naieto's gaze slid away. I can't remember, he said. Just around. Well, that information is wrong. It seemed pretty clear that Naieto was lying, and John realized that his own knee-jerk reaction had only convinced the commander that the rumblings he'd heard were true. And even if it wasn't, it's classified. Naieto gave a wry smile. They must have been talking about somebody else then, he said. I had a buddy in the ODSTs who used to train against these 8-year-old kids on Reach. They kept kicking his company's ass in jungle maneuvers. It was probably them. Who is this buddy? Nobody important, Naieto said. The thing is, that was 7 years ago, so these kids would only be about 15 right now, I guess. Seriously, sir, who is this buddy? In any military organization, no program was immune to rumors, and the more classified it was, the juicier the stories would be. But the intel that Naieto's friend had disclosed was far too accurate to be the result of casual speculation. It was coming from someone on the inside, someone who was working with the Spartans themselves. He clearly can't be trusted with classified material. Don't worry, Naieto said. If I didn't know how to keep a secret, I wouldn't be a Prowler Commander. And as a Prowler Commander, may I respectfully say that you know your friend has been breaking all kinds of security protocols, John said. He has no idea what he might be placing at risk, and neither do you. If you don't report him, I have to report you. I have no choice. Sir. You serious? A sly look came to Naieto's eye. Those 8-year-olds were you, weren't they? I didn't say that. You didn't have to, Naieto retorted. Huh. How about that? So, how long has the Spartan program been going on? How many of you are there, anyway? I can't talk about that. And you're not doing yourself any favors by asking. Naieto suddenly looked disappointed. Sorry, John. I didn't mean to make you uncomfortable. He shrugged and looked up the passageway. You do what you have to. I'll be okay. John began to feel guilty and confused. He hadn't violated any regulations. In fact, John had done everything by the book. But his denials only seemed to confirm the rumors Naieto had already heard. It would have been better to keep quiet and report the conversation later. But then Oni would start sniffing around, and Naieto would be even more certain that his friend was telling the truth. John glanced back toward the drop bay and wished Avery Johnson was at his side. The sergeant had a knack for dealing with unofficial situations like this, a talent developed over 2 decades that allowed him to safely navigate the murky backwaters of Special Forces service. It was one of the skills John knew his superiors wanted him to pick up from the sergeant, and a skill that John realized he sorely needed to develop. He looked back to Naieto. Maybe we should forget this conversation ever happened, sir. I'll chalk it up to mere scuttlebutt. And you might want to tell your friend he talks too much. No need, Naieto said. He died during Operation Trebuchet. My wing inserted his company.
I'm very sorry to hear that, John said. A lot of ODSTs had died during Operation Trebuchet, but he could at least confirm the basics of Naedo's story and see what Sergeant Johnson made of it.
He looked toward the access hatch, then started to raise his helmet toward his head.
If that's all, sir, I should probably seal up.
Of course, Naedo said,
and just so you know, nobody in the Prowler Wing supports what Crowther is doing.
John paused with his helmet at chest height.
Doing, sir?
To your Spartans, Naedo said. It's stupid to make you fight from the back. Everybody knows you tanks should be leading the charge.
I agree. It is an odd tactic, John said. He was starting to think that he'd been too suspicious of Naedo.
But the Colonel hasn't fought with us before. He doesn't know our capabilities.
Naedo snorted in disgust. The Colonel is trying to protect his reputation.
He doesn't want his black daggers being shown up by a bunch of teenagers.
No.
Really? John kept his helmet at chest height. I can't believe that, sir. He wouldn't allow personal pride to affect his tactical planning. Not with an ODST command.
Oh, maybe not on purpose.
But so what? Your Spartans are still fighting from the back. The operation is still going to suffer.
John exhaled.
Yeah. What am I supposed to do about it?
Before Naedo could answer, the hatch slid open, and Avery Johnson stepped into the passageway. His reflective faceplate turned first in Naedo's direction, then in John's.
Everything all right out here?
Even through the external speaker of his assault armor, his voice sounded gravelly and familiar.
Lieutenant Ham wants to vac the bay in two.
That will be fine, Sergeant. We're done here.
As Naedo spoke, his gaze remained fixed on John.
Just do what you do best, son. It'll work out in the end.
I will, sir. John raised his hand in a salute. And thank you.
Any time, John.
Naedo returned the salute and started up the passage. Johnson watched him go, then turned to John and spoke over his external speaker.
What was that about?
Tell you later, Sarge.
John slipped his helmet on, then turned back toward the drop bay.
The bay vax in too, remember?
Chapter 8. 1433 hours, March 18th, 2526, military calendar. UNSC Razor-class Prowler Ghost Song. Insertion run. Mass driver launching docks. Sayoba Ice Quarry. John felt his weight sink as the Ghost Song pulled up, sweeping across Sayoba toward the drop zone. The bulkhead alert lamps flashed one last time, flooding the crowded bay with steady green go light, and the Prowler decelerated hard. John could see nothing outside, but he knew they were entering the first platoon dismount area. They would be 100 meters above a kilometer-wide ice bench, with the vast quarry pit behind them and a ring of frozen slopes ahead. It was hardly an ideal drop zone, but they were infantry. They got out where they were told. The jump hatch split down the center. Looking over the mass of ODST helmets ahead of him, John saw 4 troopers at the front of the platoon dive through the exit portal. Before he could blink, they began to trail plumes of crimson mist. Then a jet of vapor erupted from a thruster pack, and the entire 4-trooper team vanished in a cloud of blood and flame. The next team did not even hesitate. They stepped forward and spouted geysers of blood and tissue. Then ricochets started to bounce off the overhead, and troopers began to drop everywhere in the bay. John heard his own voice inside his helmet. Damn it! Then he realized that this was the moment he had told himself to be ready for. It was a terrible moment, a tragic one, and he needed to fix it. He started forward, using his forearms to plow aside anyone in his way. The motion tracker on his HUD showed Avery Johnson following close behind. Lieutenant Ham's voice came over the first platoon comm channel. Abort! Emplacements! Abort! The Ghost Song began to glide forward. A trooper bounced off John's thruster pack and went down with a hole twice the size of a thumb punched through the front of his helmet. John used his foot to roll him over and saw a star-shaped exit hole on the opposite side.
John, Johnson said over Team Comm. Although Team Comm was a Spartan-only channel, Dr. Halsey had given the sergeant access to facilitate his role as a Spartan ODST liaison.
What the hell?
Look at the holes. John maneuvered his boot to flip the trooper back over so Johnson could see the entry hole. The same size. That means armor-piercing rounds. Big ones. Probably depleted uranium.
Probably from Vulcans, Johnson agreed. He was referring to the M-41 light anti-aircraft gun, a cumbersome weapon that had to be either vehicle or turret-mounted in order to fire accurately.
They were waiting for us.
I'll buy they were ready, John said.
But waiting?
That would mean they knew.
I know what it means. The ghost song accelerated hard, climbing away from the Vulcan fire and leaving John's stomach behind. He pushed forward another few steps and came to the jump hatch, where an injured trooper lay across the threshold, more outside the drop bay than inside it. Lieutenant Ham and another ODST were holding the unconscious soldier by the arms, struggling against the prowler's thrust to pull him back into the drop bay, and losing the fight. John placed a boot in the guide track to keep the hatch from closing, then lifted the man inside and passed him to Ham. Blood was frothing out of armor punctures in the soldier's chest, abdomen, and hip. By dropping a casualty into the lieutenant's lap, John hoped to buy a few moments to check the situation below. It worked. Ham immediately hit the wounded man's thruster pack quick-release and got busy saving his life. John turned back to the portal. 200 meters below, a torrent of munitions strikes was spraying icy shards off the moon's frozen surface. Sayoba's gravity was barely an 1/8 G, so there was only a trace atmosphere, and the shards sublimated instantly into vapor and began to drift across the battlefield in banks of crystalline mist. In the milky twilight, John could see more than a dozen black-armored corpses scattered across the 4 drop zones beneath Ghost Flight's prowlers. A like number of survivors were maneuvering through veils of glimmering fog, taking heavy fire from 3 sides as they tried to reach a row of ice-coated preparation docks. It wasn't easy to trace the enemy fire back to its sources, but a few heartbeats later, John spotted a series of bunkers dug into the steep slopes that ringed the dockyard. The emplacements had been carefully faced with layers of ice, camouflaged so perfectly that their locations were betrayed only by muzzle flashes blinking through their embrasures. John was almost relieved. They were ready, but not waiting, he said, speaking to Johnson over Team Comm. It took hours to build and camouflage those bunkers. Johnson came and stood next to him in the portal.
So?
So, we left Slipspace less than 30 minutes ago, John said. They didn't have time to build all that just for us. It's general preparedness. Has to be.
That's one possibility.
You think they were tipped off before we slipped?
I think it'd be foolish to rule that out.
John thought for a moment, then said,
No way.
That early. The tip would have to come from command level. Nobody else knew the target.
So you've never seen someone with brass on the collar let a secret slip? Johnson asked. Or put other loyalties before duty?
As a matter of fact, John hadn't seen a senior officer make either mistake, but he took the sergeant's point. Colonel Crowther was doing a pretty good job of putting his own ego before the mission, so it wasn't hard to imagine him, or some other brass hat, doing something that compromised mission security. John exhaled in frustration.
Are you always such a pessimist, Sarge?
Yeah. I'm infantry.
Okay, John said. Fair enough. The ghost song was a kilometer above the battlefield now, and John could see the frost-crusted tube of a century-old magnetic mass driver rising up from the docks, climbing the face of a 2,000-meter ice mountain. The end was located just below the summit, pointing at the pink-swaddled immensity of Biko. John knew from the mission briefing that the mass driver had once launched 1,000-ton payloads of steel-encapsulated ice toward the planet. As the ice capsules entered the exosphere, they were intercepted by the purchaser, then guided to a rendezvous in the stratosphere, attached to a dirigible, and floated gently to their final destination. But like the quarry itself, the mass driver had gone out of service in 2424, after Biko had finally developed a climate humid enough to supply its own rain. On the summit of the ice mountain, just above the mass driver's muzzle, sat the comm center Naieto had mentioned earlier. It was surrounded by strike craters, but largely intact, with the relay antenna lying on its side and still half-attached to its base. If the insurrectionists had a half-decent comm technician supervising repairs, they'd need no more than a half-hour to erect a new antenna and restore their communications. On the opposite side of the jump hatch, Lieutenant Ham stuck the last patch over the last hole in the casualty's armor, then passed the injured man off to a pair of subordinates. As she stood, she faced John and hooked a thumb toward the casualty. "Smooth move, Spartan." She was speaking over the first platoon channel. "Don't ever pull something like that again."
"Of course not, ma'am," John said. "I should have passed him to a corpsman."
"Damn right," Ham said. "And you're not supposed to be up here in the first place. You're out of position."
"Yes, ma'am."
As the platoon's designated fire support soldier, John was carrying a variety of heavy weapons. He removed the largest, a man-portable Spanker rocket launcher, from the magnetic holder on the back of his Mjolnir.
"Very sorry about that, ma'am."
Ham's faceplate followed the Spanker as John brought it over his shoulder. "Spartan 117, what the hell do you think you're doing?"
"Volunteering, ma'am."
John armed the Spanker's first tube. "We need to take out those bunkers." Avery Johnson placed a restraining hand on his forearm, but John shook it off and linked the Spanker's targeting sight to his heads-up display. The conversation with Naieta remained fresh in his mind, and he had no intention of letting Crowther's jealousy screw up the assault. At least, not any more than it already had been. Johnson grabbed John's arm again.
"John, you can't fire that thing in here. You'll crisp half the platoon."
John glanced down at Johnson. "I know the safety parameters of an MAV-AV bore 102mm M41 rocket launcher, Sergeant." He put the firing rest on his shoulder and focused his HUD targeting reticle on the nearest bunker. The prowler was still climbing, and the distance had increased to a kilometer and a half. "Besides, we're out of range." Ham's voice grew sharp. "Spartan 117! But John was already stepping out of the prowler. In Sayoba's weak gravity, it would have taken him nearly a minute to simply fall the 1,100 meters back into the Spanker's effective range. He hit his thrusters and accelerated downward. That would cut his descent time to more like 10 seconds. Still, if he gave the enemy gunners that long to track him on a straight line, he would arrive full of holes. Being careful to keep his HUD's targeting reticle locked on the bunker, he began to make random changes of vector. Avery Johnson's voice sounded over team comm.
"Blue team, dismount! Come heavy!"
John continued to drop, and he began to see Vulcan muzzles flashing through the bunker embrasures. The weapons were using vacuum-suitable tracers, so he could see that the insurrectionists' fire was lagging well behind his maneuvers, though by less and less as the range decreased. Finally, after he had descended a full kilometer, John reversed thrust. He decelerated hard, but had built a lot of velocity and was still dropping fast. By the time he fired the rocket launcher, the range had fallen to 350 meters. The missile streaked away in blinding brilliance, shrinking into a silver dot as John rolled into an evasive corkscrew. He felt a round glance off his thigh armor. The gunner was still firing as his bunker erupted into a spray of steam and ice. John followed a second line of tracers back to another bunker and spotted the flash of an additional Vulcan. He designated it as a target and fired the Spanker's second barrel. The round streaked away. Then Sayoba's milky surface was coming up fast. John managed to get his legs under him as he landed, but lost his footing on the slick terrain and went sliding. He had managed to land in Alpha Company's drop zone and was still on the ice bench between the quarry pit and the launching docks, gliding along on his back, watching arm-length geysers rise behind him as Vulcan rounds stitched the white ground. Tossing the empty Spanker aside, he rolled onto his hip and slapped off, launching himself 3 meters high in the weak gravity. John snatched the MA-5B off its holder, then pumped an HE grenade into the underslung launcher and swung it toward the bunker from which his attacker was firing. Then, before he could fire, saw the entire front wall erupt in a spray of bodies and ice blocks.
Kelly 087's voice came over TeamCom. Thanks for the invite, Sergeant Johnson. Blue Leader likes to hog the fun.
Not this time, John said. He touched down almost gently, then turned to see masses of ice and what was left of their insurrectionist attackers fanning down the slopes below four more wrecked bunkers. Let's form up in the docks. Switch comms back to Alpha.
A series of green LEDs acknowledged the order, and John raced across the ice toward the launching docks, using his thrusters and sometimes his feet to dodge enemy fire. The low gravity and poor traction made it difficult to change directions abruptly, and a few times he found himself falling to a knee or flying 10 meters on a single course. Falling was not much of a problem, but there were still hundreds of insurrectionists hiding in hollows or behind ice blocks on the surrounding slopes, and they were decent marksmen. Whenever he continued on a straight line for more than a second or two, he began to feel small arms fire dinging his Mjolnir armor. John returned fire as he moved, of course, and took out a few attackers. But the battalion intelligence squad had either lost its reconnaissance drones or failed to establish a Mjolnir link-up, and the tac map on his HUD remained blank. So he devoted most of his attention to reconnoitering, looking for anything large enough to be an enemy hangar, or trying to guess how long it would be before the insurrectionists got their comm center working again. Unfortunately, the largest part of the battlefield lay more or less behind him, in the sheer walled vastness of the quarry pit itself. Easily 10 kilometers in diameter, the pit was the shape of an octopus, with a large central cavity surrounded by long curving canyons that extended farther than John could see. The walls were pocked by caves with oddly shaped mouths, many of them large enough to hold a transport vessel of considerable size. The bottom of the quarry could not be seen from his angle, but a blanket of fog was rising into view, with prowlers dipping in and out as they swirled down to drop their platoons or lay fire on enemy positions. In all likelihood, the insurrectionist transports were hidden somewhere in the bottom of the vast quarry, and it would fall to Crowther to be sure the enemy vessels were disabled before they could launch and sound the alarm. It was not a task John felt good about entrusting to someone else, least of all the colonel. But he had no choice. A convoy of tracked civets was climbing a service road toward the top of the mass driver, their cargo boxes loaded with soldiers in pressure-sealed armor, heavy weapons, and equipment to repair the damaged comm center. The ghost flight prowlers came swooping over the battlefield, their belly turrets spewing streams of 30-millimeter rounds, and their drop bays trailing dark-armored ODSTs. The incoming fire faded to almost nothing as the enemy took cover, and John hit his thrusters and leap-soared the last 100 meters to the fog-swaddled docks. There was a total of 10 separate structures, each about 2 meters high and as wide and long as a Pelican dropship without the wings. A set of ice-caked rails ran the length of their decks, serving as guide tracks for a huge gantry crane that stood about halfway to the bottom end of the mass driver. A half-dozen ODSTs had already taken shelter in the sunken capsuling bays between docks and were standing on their toes, holding their assault weapons over their heads so they could return fire. John dropped into an unoccupied bay near the center of the row and saw a flight of M-28 Shrieker missiles flash from the prowlers toward the civet convoy. The mountainside erupted into geysers and hid the Saoban sky behind a boiling curtain of steam. Then a pair of yellow streaks lanced back through the fog toward the attacking prowlers. An orange ball blossomed inside the cloud and began a slow descent behind the mountain.
"That's it for us," Nieto said, speaking over Alpha Channel. "We're bingo ammo and down one bird. You're on your own, Alpha."
"Affirmative," answered the raspy voice of Captain Zelos Cuvier, the Alpha Company commander. "Thanks for the ride, Ghost Man. We have it from here."
John was not so sure. With enemy fire picking up again, and raining down from three sides, he didn't need a tac map to tell him Alpha Company was more or less surrounded. And when he stuck his head up to check on the comm center, he could just make out a ghostly line of civets still climbing through the fog toward the mountaintop. There seemed to be only about half as many as before, but that was at least 7 vehicles, plenty to carry the repair crew and a heavy weapons platoon to protect them. John's motion tracker showed 5 friendlies entering the capsuling bay behind him.
the rest of Blue Team, plus Avery Johnson and Lieutenant Ham. He crouched down behind the cover of an ice-crusted steel half-capsule that had been hanging alongside the dock for the last century, then went to meet them. Lieutenant Ham was first in line. Not bothering to crouch, her helmet was still half a meter beneath the top of the dock, she stepped forward and jammed a gloved finger against John's breastplate. "You disobeyed my order." "Sorry, ma'am," John said. "By the time I realized what you were saying, I was already 2 steps out of the drop bay." "Because you stepped off without authorization. Spartans are trained to take the initiative." As John said this, Fred and Kelly remained behind Ham, looming over her and turning their helmets back and forth in astonishment. Linda just kept her faceplate turned toward the civic convoy and showed no sign she was listening. Naturally, I assumed ODSTs were too. Cute. Ham grabbed John by the top of his armored chest plate, then pulled him down in an effort to equalize their height. "If I allow you to stay in my platoon, you're going to learn to follow orders. And until you do, your life is going to be one long shit shine after another. Is that clear, Spartan?" "Yes, ma'am." John had never heard the term shit shine before, but he suspected it involved polishing hardware with a non-approved agent. He glanced over his shoulder toward the magnetic catapult. "How about a suggestion?" "How about a sit-rep instead?" Johnson said, sounding almost mad. "That should have been the first thing you communicated when you rejoined your platoon leader. Or do they not teach battle protocol in Spartan school?" "They do." John did not point out that Ham had given him no chance to communicate anything before reading him the riot act, because he was pretty sure Johnson realized that already. The sergeant was a master at convincing officers that what he wanted them to do was their own idea. John pointed up the fog-shrouded slope toward the top of the mass driver, then began his situation report. "Ma'am, there's a convoy of 7 tracked civets climbing toward the disabled comm center at the top of the mountain. They have repair equipment, a security force of at least platoon strength, and heavy weapons, including at least 1 vehicle-mounted multiple rocket launcher." "The one that got the ghost star?" Ham's helmet tipped back as she searched for the convoy. Then she finally seemed to see them. "Well, crap in a helmet. They're halfway up now." "Yes, ma'am," John said. "We need to stop them." "No kidding." Ham turned away and dropped her chin in the posture of someone carrying on a conversation inside her helmet, then finally returned her attention to her companions. "Ascot says no strafing runs. The prowlers are out of shriekers, and with those rocket launchers on the civets, she doesn't want to risk losing another boat." "So," Johnson sighed, "the hard way." Ham shrugged her armored shoulders. "You know what they say. Infantry is the queen of the battlefield." Just about every soldier who had been through infantry school in the last 500 years understood the reference. In the game of chess, the queen was the most versatile piece on the board, and in a war, infantry was the most versatile force on the battlefield. Ham studied the mountainside, trying to assess whether her platoon stood any chance of surviving an uphill assault on a convoy equipped with heavy weapons, all while being attacked from both flanks. The answer was, of course, no way in hell. Her faceplate shifted toward John and the rest of Blue Team. He felt pretty sure that she was pondering their capabilities, wondering whether the 4 of them could accomplish what would be impossible for an ODST platoon with 10 times the personnel. John knew they could, and he was about to volunteer when a squall of ice chips and fog began to roll over their heads. A trio of inbound friendlies appeared on his motion tracker, on foot about 25 meters away, and coming from the direction of the gantry crane. "Cover fire," John ordered. He and the rest of Blue Team rose to their full height and began to loose 3 shot bursts at the slope beyond the trio, targeting the closest muzzle flashes first. The enemy fire trailed off as casualties mounted, but the survivors did not seem to realize how quickly they were being picked off and continued to attack from fixed positions. Definitely irregulars, not well trained. The lead friendly took a round in the shoulder and went down face first, sliding across the ice before pushing himself to a knee again. His companions came up on either side and slipped a hand beneath his arms, then continued forward in a straight line. Within a couple of steps, they were close enough to the capsuling bay that they were blocking Blue Team's firing lanes. 40 Mike Mike, John ordered. High arc! All four members of Blue Team pointed their MA-5Bs skyward and began firing 40-millimeter grenades from the underslung launchers. In the weak gravity, the orbs arced so high they vanished into Sayoba's dark sky. A moment later, they returned to view, a dark rain falling slowly toward the enemy positions. The insurrectionists stopped firing and craned their necks, all trying to guess whether they would be in a blast radius of a slowly incoming grenade. About half leapt up and scrambled for better cover, and were promptly cut down by the platoon of ODSTs that had taken positions on the gantry crane. The trio of friendlies reached the dock and jumped down into the capsuling berth, the injured man falling on his rear as soon as his boots hit the ice. One of his companions knelt next to him and opened his thigh pouch, then extracted a patching kit and set to work repairing the hole in his armor. Any actual first aid would have to wait until the casualty reached a pressurized environment, but space assault armor was tough stuff. Even armor-piercing ammunition surrendered most of its kinetic energy penetrating it, so there was a good chance the wound was not serious. The second companion made a beeline for Ham. There was no rank insignia on his armor. It was never smart to help snipers identify high-value targets, but the name stenciled on his breast was Cuvier, the company captain. Cuvier stopped halfway between John and Ham. Nobody saluted, but Ham stood slightly more erect. Had one of John's Spartan snipers been an enemy watching through a scope, the subtle shift of posture would have been enough to get the captain's helmet blown off. "Good work, Lieutenant," Cuvier said over the first platoon channel. "I like your initiative." "Sir?" Ham asked. "Sending in the Spartans," Cuvier said. "That was brilliant. You saved a lot of ODSTs. Maybe the whole operation." Ham's faceplate shifted in John's direction. But before she could set the record straight, Avery Johnson spoke up. "It was quick thinking, sir. But don't blame Lieutenant Ham for jumping the gun. That's all on me."
"Jumping the gun, Sergeant?"
"Failing to confirm the deployment order. Once things started moving, I just got excited and—" Cuvier waved him off.
"There wasn't time."
He turned back to Ham. "By the time he explained the plan, it would have been too late to make it work. I know that."
"Thank you, Captain."
Ham's tone was strained.
"I appreciate your understanding.
But let's keep this between us." Cuvier's faceplate pivoted toward Johnson, then to Fred, Kelly, and Linda, and finally came to a rest on John. "The Colonel isn't a big fan of spontaneity in combat operations, and I don't want him blaming Lieutenant Ham for doing her job. Clear?" After everyone had acknowledged the order, Cuvier craned his neck to look up the mountainside toward the convoy of civets.
"I was monitoring your conversation with Captain Ascot," he said. "So, tell me, what do you need from me to stop that repair company without Prowler support?"
Ham looked toward John and his team.
"Just your blessing, sir."
"You have it," Cuvier said, also turning toward the Spartans. "Tell me what you have in mind."
"We need to beat those civets to the comm center," Ham said, "and right now, the Spartans are the fastest thing we have. I suggest we send them up the mass driver."
Cuvier continued to study the mountainside, no doubt inspecting, as John was, the ice-crusted tube running up the slope. A full 3 meters in diameter, it was easily large enough to hold the Spartans and any munitions they would need to demolish the comm center and attack the convoy. But over the course of a century without maintenance, several support towers had collapsed, and the curtains of ice hanging beneath some of the induction coils suggested that a half-dozen seam welds had opened. Most worrisome was a miniature glacier flowing out of the loading breach. Easily 20 meters wide and 10 meters thick, it spilled from beneath the buckled hatch and spread out in a mound the size of a small house. Judging by how far it had pushed the hatch up, the bottom half of the tube was packed with ice that had accumulated over 100 years of sublimation cycles. Cuvier nodded in approval.
"Excellent plan, Lieutenant. The enemy will never see them coming."
"Because they'll never get there," Johnson objected. "You can see from here the tube is full of ice."
"Half full," John said. After Blue Team's success in taking out the bunkers, he was feeling good about his chances of proving just how crucial his Spartans were to the success of Operation Silent Storm. If they could reach the top of the mountain in time to demolish the comm center and take out the convoy, even Colonel Crowther would be forced to admit that the Spartans should be leading the way into battle, instead of bringing up the rear. John turned to Cuvier. "Blue Team is in," he said. "We'll need some flamethrowers and thermite paste to handle blockages." "And C-7," Fred added. "The foaming explosive was especially suitable for use in a vacuum." Lots and lots of C-7. Chapter 9. Ninth Age of Reclamation, 34th Cycle, 16 Units. Covenant Battle Calendar. Fleet of Inexorable Obedience, Assault Carrier Pious Rampage, Low Polar Orbit, Planet Igeni, Illa System. It seemed a cruel way to set the unworthy on the path of oblivion, this rain of fire that devoured all it touched, that burned bone and boiled stone and turned dirt to glass. Yet so glorious was the bombardment, so magnificent the white lances blossoming upon the nomadic villages below, and so sublime the scarlet rings dilating across the smudges of green pasture, that Nizzet Cavarossi could not turn from the sight. He was master of the fleet of inexorable obedience, and this terrible beauty was his doing. The annihilation of the contemptibles was his gift to the gods of the Covenant, the tithe he offered to be deemed worthy of one day joining the ancient forerunners in divine transcendence. To turn his back on the splendor of his weapons was to abandon the great journey itself, to declare himself a traitor to his people and his faith. And that he would never do, no matter the growing darkness within. To a Sangheili warrior, one's word was all, and when Nizzet had become master of the fleet of inexorable obedience, he had sworn to execute the will of the prophets as if it were his own. The strike ended, leaving nothing in its wake but a white glowing circle the size of his palm. He nodded approvingly and turned to the frail figure floating in the anti-gravity chair next to him. With his serpentine neck and the fur-covered wattle dangling beneath his chin, the Senshayum would appear repulsively weak to most Sangheili. Yet Nizzet was careful to address him in a tone just shy of veneration. "That was the last village on this meridian, Your Grace. I will give the order to move on to the next." The Senshayum, the minor minister of Artifact Survey, waved a tri-fingered hand. "Yes, yes, Fleet Master, as you wish." The minor minister, whom Nizzet often simply called Survey in his own mind, tipped his chair forward to peer out of the blister. "How much longer, do you think?" "Not over long," Nizzet said. "Igeni is thinly populated. There are barely more than 100,000 settlements on the entire world." 100,000. Survey exhaled heavily. "And how many do you think we have destroyed?" Nizzet checked the data tab integrated into the forearm of his shipboard armor. "That makes 47,912. The Sanshayum's head sank forward. "So few. At this rate, we'll be here another full cycle." Nizzet tried to hide his revulsion. Like most Sanshayum who traveled with Covenant battle fleets, the minor minister was a ceremonial magistrate rather than a military commander, and Survey in particular seemed ill-suited to the rigors of attending a planet-cleansing operation. If the minor minister is growing weary, he should feel free to return to his compartments. There is no need to remain here. Survey's head whipped up. "No need, Fleet Master? Perhaps you believe that all the Hierarchs require of us is to kill humans." "Not at all, Your Grace," Nizzet said. "The eradication must be consecrated, I know. But I was not aware you had to observe the entire operation personally." "You are being ridiculous," Survey retorted. "That would be impossible, even for a Sanshayum."
Then I am...
Nizat stopped himself. He'd almost said he was afraid he didn't understand. But that would have been wrong. He was not afraid, and one did not lie to a Senshayum, not even to one as unimpressive as Survey. Forgive me. I do not understand. It is a matter of bearing witness.
Survey's gaze grew distant, and he held his long neck a little more erect. The hierarchs must know that the humans are paying for their transgressions, and I must be able to report how they are suffering.
Ah, now I understand. And indeed, that was the truth. Nizat's orders had said nothing about making humans suffer, only to kill them as quickly as possible, and to survey their worlds and capture those that contained Forerunner relics, and to render uninhabitable those that did not. But the Sanshayum were a political species who fought for status the way Sangheili did for honor, and it was clear that Survey intended to win favor among the hierarchs by describing in detail how the humans were dying in anguish beneath the plasma beams of the fleet of inexorable obedience. It was nothing to Nizat, and in fact the reports were only likely to enhance his reputation with the prophets, who were his superiors and Survey's, so there was no reason to make the minor minister's life any harder than it had to be.
But if I may, Your Grace, the destruction of one village is usually the same as another. Nothing of interest is likely to occur while you were attending to other matters. And if it does, I will, of course, send for you at once.
Survey considered the proposal for only a moment before inclining his elongated head.
As you wish, Fleet Master. But two cycles is a long time to waste on a mudhole such as this. Is there nothing you can do to complete your work more quickly?
Nizat hesitated, for he had pondered the subject earlier and concluded that it was feasible. Unfortunately, the method was not as certain as plasma bombardment to sterilize the world, and if it succeeded, it would prove immeasurably crueler. It was not something he was eager to try, but he had been directly asked by a minor minister, and it would be blasphemy to lie.
Did you not hear my question, Fleet Master?
I did, Nizat replied. I hesitate, because the technique has never been tried before. But this world is so primitive that it could work here.
I hope you do not expect me to guess.
Not at all, Nizat said, but there are risks.
Are we not at war? There are always risks, even when fighting the humans.
Then your guidance will be most appreciated, Nizat said. Igeni is unique in two ways that serve our purpose. First, there is a shield volcano on the equator so enormous that we can see it venting ash and steam even from orbit.
And a plasma bombardment might trigger an eruption, Survey said.
But would that be enough?
On any other world, no, Nizat said, but there is only one spaceport on the entire planet, and it has already been glassed.
So there can be no evacuation if the volcano erupts.
It would require a rescue fleet of at least 1,000 large transports, Nizat said, and what is the likelihood of that while the fleet of inexorable obedience is nearby?
No more than zero, Survey replied. But even an erupting shield volcano would blanket only a small part of the planet. It wouldn't kill everything.
Not quickly. But if there is enough ash in the sky?
Nizat waited until he saw Survey's eyes widen, then added, It would be a slow and anguishing death, Your Grace.
The minor minister's head bobbed. Perfect.
But uncertain, Nizat said. He did not enjoy the prospect of inflicting said slow and anguishing death on so many, even if Survey did. There may not be enough ash to cool the planet, and humans are nothing if not resourceful.
It matters not.
Survey gave his fingers a dismissive flutter.
Even if they survive, where can they go? When we return...
The San Shyum was interrupted by the warning rattle of mandibles in the Fleetmaster's planning compartment, and Nizzat turned to find his steward leading a warrior in indigo assault armor toward the observation blister. His blood ran cold, for the armor was the uniform of the Silent Shadow, a premier hunter-killer force that the hierarchs often dispatched when they wished to remove a high-ranking commander from his post. Unlike most warriors who came before the Fleetmaster, the Shadow had not removed his helmet, for his sect forbade them to show his face to a superior he might one day be ordered to kill. Happily, this Shadow had left the hilt of his plasma sword in its holster, and he was using both hands to carry a plate-sized disc about the thickness of his arm. For an instant, Nizzat thought it might be some kind of strange forerunner artifact. The recovery of such relics was one of the Covenant's objectives in attacking the humans, after all. But as the warrior drew closer, Nizzat saw the obvious control buttons and a lens of primitive silicate, and he realized the thing had to be a human device. Nizzat looked to his steward, then pointed to the device and demanded, "Why do you allow that abomination into my presence?" The steward, a young major named Tam Lakosi, stopped 3 paces away. Like all Sangheili warriors, he was an imposing figure with an arrow-shaped head, beady eyes, and a mouth with 4 mandibles lined by short, curved fangs. Dressed in a sleeveless tabard rather than armor, he had a heavily muscled frame, long sinewy arms that ended in 4-fingered hands, and huge legs supported by long, powerful tarsies that resulted in a springy, digitigrade gait. He touched his fingers to his brow. "Fleetmaster, all will grow clear in a moment. Until then, I beg your indulgence. You have it. For now. I will be quick." Lakosi gestured at the silent shadow beside him. "First Blade Tel Zatulai recovered the abomination on the world that humans call Amasa, in their Granati sector." Amasa, known to the fleet of inexorable obedience as Alioso, was the 10th target in line to be attacked under Nizat's current invasion plan, so he knew that Zatulai's unit would have been there to take the measure of its defenses. Even more importantly, the patrol would have been scouting for any hint that the world had once been occupied by the Holy Forerunners, who had held dominion over the galaxy before their ascent to divinity. Nizzat clacked his mandibles horizontally to indicate that he knew of the world, and Lakosi continued his explanation. "The device was left in front of Zatulai's reconnaissance squad, deliberately." "Deliberately?" Survey echoed. He floated his chair close to Zatulai and leaned forward so that his wattled face was within a finger's length of the warrior's red visor. "A First Blade of the Silent Shadow allowed himself to be seen on a world not yet under attack." Zatulai regarded Survey and did not reply. For 5 long breaths, Nizzat wondered whether the warrior was too much of a coward to speak directly to a San Shyum, or such a fool that he believed he needed his Fleetmaster's permission to reply to a minor minister. Then Zatulai spoke, and Nizzat realized he was neither. "That is so, Your Grace." There was just enough loathing in the First Blade's tone to indicate that he did not appreciate having his field performance disparaged by a member of the audience. "I made a mistake." Red circles broke out around Survey's eyes, and the San Shyum turned to Nizzat, the curl of his prehensile lips making clear that he expected such insubordination to be dealt with harshly. But Nizzat had developed a sudden fondness for this shadow. And anyway, First Blades were too valuable to sacrifice to the petulance of a minor minister. Nizzat flipped a hand in indifference. "It is nothing to worry about, Your Grace. The infidels are not feeble-minded. They already know that we are going to attack Alioso."
"That is not my concern," Survey hissed.
"I am glad we are in agreement." Nizzat turned to Zatulai. "You have ensured that this device is not a trap." The First Blade's helmet swung upward and to the right, a sign of confirmation.
We captured the courier and forced her to demonstrate its use before she died. It brought harm to none of us.
Well done, Nizat said. Then tell me,
why is this device worthy of my attention? Because it contains a message from a faction of humans who wish to help us.
A trick, Servais said. Why would any human help destroy their own species?